From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Brendan Gill. He's written for The New Yorker magazine for more than 50 years. There's a new edition of his bestseller here at The New Yorker, and he's just completed a biography of architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Also today, I talk with director John Borman. His new film, Hope and Glory, looks at World War II from a child's perspective. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new solo album by Robbie Robertson, the former leader of the group The Band. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Cry Freedom, Richard Attenborough's movie based on the life of black South African leader Stephen Biko and his friend white journalist Donald Woods. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Brendan Gill once wrote, "Happy writers have histories shorter even than happy families. The whole of my professional career can be summed up by saying that I started out at the place where I wanted most to be, the New Yorker magazine." Since selling his first New Yorker story back in 1936, my guest Brendan Gill has written short stories, profiles, talk of the town pieces, and theater reviews. The life of that magazine was the subject of his best-selling book here at The New Yorker. A new edition has just been published with an updated introduction chronicling the end of an era. Last year, the magazine was sold to a new publisher, which ended William Shawn's 36-year editorship. In January, Gill revived the long-dormant Skyline column about architecture, which Lewis Mumford used to write. Gill had already immersed himself in the subject of architecture while preparing his biography of architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Gill knew Wright as a reporter, then as a friend. The biography has just been published. It's called Many Masks, A Life of Frank Lloyd Wright. Welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with Frank Lloyd Wright's epitaph on his tombstone, which reads, "Love of an idea is love of God." What does that mean to you?
It's a nonsensical epitaph for that man, and I'm afraid it was the handiwork of his widow, Olga Vanna, who rather fancied herself as a mystic, and there is no possible way that you can analyze that and make that make any sense. And Frank Lloyd Wright himself had no particular belief in God. He was a kind of, as I'm afraid I described him, as a kind of maudlin pantheist, a maudlin Whitmanesque pantheist. But he wouldn't have thought that that was a good thing to put on his tombstone. And it was like the family motto, truth against the world, which the Wright family always believed that it possessed. But if you analyze truth against the world, that doesn't mean anything either. What truth? Whose truth? And what world? Whose world? So it's a kind of a grandiose statement, which is best not thought about.
It must have been difficult on one level for you to write this book because he was a friend of yours in the latter years of his life. And I think, in a way you want a certain distance when you're writing somebody's autobiography. It helps to know them, but then you don't know what your responsibility is to them as a friend and what your responsibility should be as a biographer.
Well, if the man is great enough, and if also the very question of the nature of his greatness has been discussed with him, as it was in my case, more than once, because he was perfectly aware of the fact of his greatness and great indeed encouraged everybody to believe that he was as great as he himself believed himself to be, which is the greatest it could be. That makes it less embarrassing to find out that the many things that he caused to come into the world as inventions about himself were devices, were forms of manipulation of the public, because the work is there, the greatness is there. You wouldn't be bothered dealing with a man who lied and stole and cheated and did all these other things if he was simply an nonentity. But great people are worth examining, and everything about them, as Oliver Cromwell said about his warts, is necessary. Put in the warts. And Frank and I often talked about the fact that that there was an element of charlatanism in him, of being a mountebank. And what did that mean? And of course, he gave what is the characteristic answer of mountebanks, but nevertheless possibly the true one, that he said, "I could never get my work done. I couldn't have got done what I wanted to get done without having been this kind of show-off, this element of the braggadocio and all that." And I think that that's legitimate. I think most of the great men of my time, like Picasso and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, other people like that, have had a great quality of showmanship in them, which we might deplore. We wouldn't expect it of Washington or Jefferson, but we expect it now of our public figures, and perhaps it marks a falling off in the quality of the apprehension of life that we have.
You've recently turned to architecture as a subject to write about, both in the Frank Lloyd Wright biography and in your new column.
Well, but
in
I've
the
always
New Yorker.
Written about architecture more or less indirectly, and I myself always boast, not unlike the fashion of Frank Lloyd Wright, that I was an architect from the cradle because I always cared about it. That's been my avocation all my life. And but I didn't want to become an architect because I didn't like taking the courses that were necessary to be taken at Yale at that time. So I chose to be what is called a generalist by just concentrating on writing. But I've always drawn and always worked in architecture and remodeled houses and done things like that.
What do you love about architecture on an idea level?
Well, I think that it does stand for shelter. And I think there are some people who are very much interested in providing shelter for the sense of coziness, some primordial sense of being inside a cave. And all my life, I've made caves for my family. And all Frank Lloyd Wright's life, he was making caves. He was the consummate cave maker, the great hearth, the snugness, the little windows on that side, then the opening up at the cave mouth of the great windows looking south over the lawns and gardens and all that. And I think that those, that element in him answers something in us which probably goes back 18,000 years. It probably goes back to Lascaux. And I think that that's one of the tests of a good building is that whether you know why you're happy inside that building or not, something in that building makes you happy. You feel better than you would in a building that makes you uneasy. Much of contemporary architecture, you know, makes you uneasy. And at first we don't understand why, but there are reasons.
I want to quote something that you wrote in your first Skyline column, your first New Yorker column on architecture. You wrote, "It is the wanton and ever-accelerating destruction of New York in the name of improving it that I will be addressing in this column." And then you started to write about all the new buildings that are going up in Manhattan that are mostly being bought up by out-of-town millionaires, yeah. by foreign millionaires.
And I say in the column I had in last week's New Yorker that I don't even know who any of these people are. You know, they're crudely referred to as Euro sleaze, these people who come in with immense fortunes and are buying up our sunlight and our air in these areas in the sky. And you look up at them at night and they're all dark, 10 or 15 floors without a light because they're not living there. They're simply warehousing our sunlight and air for future profit, and it's an intolerable situation. It's absentee wealth, and left behind and unable to live in the very island that they ought to be living on are all the young folk who are now living an hour out of New York and living in slums and paying $1,000 a month for one small room in a basement. It cannot go on, and the indictment that has to be made is to be made to the city government. We have a rotten city government in New York, and it is getting worse. The city continues to be given away.
So you said that the heart of the city is increasingly being owned by absentee landlords. Do you think that this is something peculiar to Manhattan, or is this a problem that you see happening in other major cities in America?
Well, the great cities have had all of them to face that, but of course New York is the magnet. New York is the greatest city on earth, and it is believed to be that by people who can afford to come here from Hong Kong and Shanghai. And every other city, longingly, we are the center of so many things. And we are, in any event, a great city. People, we have something incandescent in New York. We have an energy that almost no other city on earth, I think, has, except my second favorite city, which is L.A., a very unfashionable point of view to have. Everybody wants me to think that San Francisco is better than Los Angeles, but I know that Los Angeles is better than San Francisco because the energy there is coming up out of the street, too. You just feel it. And I don't know enough about LA to know whether that too is being given away in the same sense that, but we violate the law in New York. We have no more zoning in New York. Anybody who can afford it can break the law in effect, can see to it that he has a separate arrangement with the city.
But probably you wouldn't think of living anywhere else.
No, I want to be there. I want to see what's happening. Even in when it's threatened, as I really believe that it was as threatened as Rome was threatened with decline and fall, one wants to be there.
My guest is Brendan Gill, and his latest book is a biography of Frank Lloyd Wright titled Many Masks. There's also a new edition of his bestseller here at The New Yorker. Now, you've been at The New Yorker for over 50 years, which is really a remarkably long time, especially in this day and age where people change jobs like crazy. Now, you've seen magazines around you go through radical changes. What are some of the changes that you've noticed, not at The New Yorker, but at other magazines?
Well, when I was young and just beginning to be a writer, just out of Yale, and I not only was writing for The New Yorker at once, and therefore went on the staff, but I used to write for the Saturday Evening Post. I was a short story writer, and I was thought to be going to be a successor to their great short story writers. And one got a lot more money writing for the Saturday Evening Post, of course, in those days than The New Yorker, which paid very little. And I used to write for Collier's and for Liberty and all those other magazines, and they've all vanished. There were no outlets. I was a serious young man, meaning to write as good short stories as I could, and I would have had the opportunity to sell my stories in maybe 20 or 30 magazines. Nowadays, there are only maybe three or four magazines in which it would be possible to publish the kind of stories that people could take seriously and be eager to see, and a couple of them are serious quarterlies, like Grand Street, for example, which is a new magazine, which is very good about publishing excellent short stories. But that is a big change, because in those days all we had was radio, and we didn't have television, and we didn't have the other seductions of life, and everything depends upon where the money is. And there evidently isn't money enough in terms of advertising to support more than a few magazines which want to take subjects seriously. And the oddity of The New Yorker is that now, today, we're the only magazine probably that if it wants to tackle a serious subject, can tackle it at 10,000 words, 20,000 words. People complain, but the fact is that if you have the guts to tackle an important subject, you can't do it in 1,200 words. You can't do it in this quick TV commercial space of time.
Well, certainly what a lot of New Yorker readers are wondering is, will the new publisher and the new editor, Robert Gottlieb, continue that tradition of pieces taking as long as they need to take? Or will it fall into line with other magazines of having more emphasis on graphics and design and shorter articles that can be easily skimmed or quickly read?
I would hope not, because among other things, I am still employed there myself, which I think is a good sign. And my pieces will be running to 6,000 or 8,000 words, because I can't make an indictment of New York City in 1,000 words. That's just like spitting on it or something. But the multi-part, it is said that Bob Gottlieb is opposed to the multi-part pieces of some of the three or four part pieces that we have run in the past. But so far, in the first 6 or 8 months of his rule, nothing that I know of has changed very much in that respect. And his record, which people tend to forget, that the reason that Cy Newhouse, our new owner, chose Gottlieb to succeed Sean is because Gottlieb had a reputation in book publishing, which is just as high as Sean's reputation in magazine publishing. They were both thought to be great editors and peers of one another. And the outcry at The New Yorker was totally unjustified, as far as I'm concerned, because Gottlieb is intellectually as respectable as any human being we have. And look at what Knopf, of which he was the head editor, has published over the years. They tackle tough subjects at great length. They publish unpopular books.
There was a letter that was written to Gottlieb asking him to resign.
Even before he took office.
So I take it you didn't sign that letter?
I didn't sign it because I thought that was an example of mass hysteria on the part of many writers for whom The New Yorker acts as a kind of surrogate family and surrogate home. And that's nice in one level, but it's not nice on the level of fearing change. I remember I told Sean that I had heard once that the Chinese pictograph for change is the same as the pictograph for opportunity. And that's a wonderful thought. But in the New Yorker staff view, change represented panic, danger, rather than opportunity. And now I think it's all settled down, and I think most of the writers are perfectly content. One or two left, but not many. And we are as eager as ever to be seen to be in that magazine. This is our natural place to be.
You had worked with one editor for 36 years. Was it difficult to adjust to somebody else going over your copy?
Oh, yeah, of course we miss Sean as an old friend. And also all our lives long, we have been writing not for our readers, because one doesn't do that, but for each other. And what I always sought if I wrote a piece was the approbation of William Shawn and Joseph Mitchell and a couple of friends like that. And then if anybody else in the world also liked what I wrote, I was grateful. But my heart was with them and with seeking their approval. And so I miss and I'm bound to miss Shawn as a friend of 50 years in terms of not any longer being able to seek his approbation. But I will then gradually be eager for Bob Gottlieb to praise me. All we live for is praise.
I know a lot of writers say they get paid so little, they'd better get some praise.
No, but that's what really nourishes us. Money gives delight, but praise is nourishing.
My guest is Brendan Gill, who has written for The New Yorker for over 50 years. His best-selling book here at The New Yorker has a new edition that was just brought out. He's also written a new biography of Frank Lloyd Wright called Many Masks. We're going to talk about his writing more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is writer Brendan Gill. William Shawn, who edited The New Yorker for about 36 years, is probably one of the most, if not the most, now legendary living editors. And I'd like to hear a little bit about what it was like to work with him. When you would write something, knowing that he would edit it, would there be a little William Shawn voice in your head going over what you were writing as you were writing it?
I suppose unconsciously there is that sense that one wants to do well, as a child might want to do well, to do something to seek the parents' pride or praise. Knowing, I suppose to some extent, it would be a defect in one's character to think that knowing the character of the editor, one would write in that direction. So I wouldn't say that we consciously did that, but we could not be affected by it. And now we, having to write for a new person, will make that alteration in our nature.
What did you know that he would say? What did you know he would look for?
Among other things, one knew what he wouldn't like. John Updike, who was rejoiced to be naughty with Shawn and would always put a few four-letter words into his short stories, and then they would perhaps one or two of them would reach the first galleys. And then Shawn would plead, and then, of course, John would take them out. It meant nothing to him except to cause Shawn momentary terror, because Updike knew the short stories would come out in book form, and as he wrote them, with the dirty, so-called, from Sean's point of view, dirty words, they would be intact. And so there was a certain amount of teasing, I think, of that kind. But it was true, however, that that may have been a defect in the magazine. And Pauline Kael began to make great cultural literary history by introducing one or two four-letter words into her movie columns just before Sean left. But it was always over his protests. And it was only when he saw that, indeed, the language, our contemporary language, is not the language of his youth. He himself has never uttered an imprecation more violent than a very softly whispered, "Oh, God." And beyond that, he has never explored the territory of invective. But as we know, his beloved and wonderful son, Wally Shawn, writes in contemporary speech in a way that must cause Shawn alarm.
Well, in your book here at The New Yorker, you say that one person wrote a short story with the expression cow patty in it.
Yeah.
And once Shawn had figured out that meant cow dung, he wrote at the first mention he wrote "oh dear" in the margin, and at the second mention he wrote "surely once is enough." And I wonder how you feel about that kind of gentility. On the one hand, it's in a way what makes one of the things that makes The New Yorker so special. On the other hand, it could be very frustrating to be up against that kind of gentility if you want to cut loose with what you're writing.
Yeah, and under Ross in the old days, swear words were always permitted. We were the only magazine which you could say Jesus Christ or something in a short story. And then the nuns would come in and frighten Ross. They'd hang around the corridor waiting to see him, to scold him for the bad language. But he was speaking American First World War Army language, and he never would utter any of these common naughty words of our day, which are sexual in origin, and especially not in the presence of a woman. But Sean was even more extreme in that respect than Ross had been, and he never used even the ordinary bad, the blasphemies. And now blasphemy is such a commonplace that that wouldn't count at all. And when Sean had the intention of publishing the best black writing in America as it was coming out after the Second World War and all those years, and in point of fact, he couldn't because he'd prevented himself from doing so because the natural black language in which they write their powerful short stories is a language that he found impermissible, and he just couldn't bring himself to publish it in the magazine. So it was stultifying not to have that privilege. And the writers who wrote in that language and who write in that language today are not being Peck's bad boy. They're not showing off. This is the natural tongue. These are the words now that my beautiful granddaughters use in my presence, to my astonishment and somewhat to my dismay. But there they are.
Is that something you ever spoke with William Sean about?
Oh, yes. His argument was that the words were much more conspicuous in a magazine than they were in a book, that you sort of accepted a different frame of reference or a different possibility of speech in a book. And he would say, yes, of course, Ulysses is full of bad language, but the New Yorker magazine, they would start off the page. And I think that was a justification. There's something in it, but not it was not the truth. The truth was that it was offensive to him. And the great editor says, I like this or I don't like this. And he has the limits of his good qualities as well as those of his bad. And so the magazine very much reflected the nature of Sean's feeling about how life should be conducted now.
Do you think we'll be seeing a change in the kind of language?
Oh, yeah, I think so. It was, as I say, already beginning to take place under Sean, and Gottlieb doesn't have any of these worries. He's of another generation anyway. Sean is 80. He's of a different generation, even to some extent from me. He's a little bit older than I am.
You've written a lot of Talk of the Town pieces, mm-hmm. which are unattributed pieces. They're unsigned pieces toward the beginning of the magazine. And I always wonder for the people who write that, what it feels like to not get credit for what you've written. And you've done it a lot.
Yeah.
Did you really want to sign your name to it? Well, I've never understood this tradition of not signing pieces.
Well, it was an attempt to give the appearance of uniformity to
this collective
was,
we.
To a we. And it also made it possible for lots of different people to be writing in abundance, with a seeming abundance, in a way in which it would detract from that sense of abundance if each piece was signed. You say, well, of course you can put together four different people. But also having no names was a tradition in the magazine that grew up by accident. We erected this accident into a virtue. But when The New Yorker began, all humorous magazines had only pseudonyms and initials. Nobody ever signed his real name to anything. Much less, and Talk of the Town used to be signed The New Yorkers. And then we dropped that byline. But the clothing department was called signed Lipstick. And so it went.
You write in your book here at The New Yorker that happiness is an emotion not often spoken of at the magazine, much less experienced. It's very funny the way you put it, but I have a feeling that beneath that humor is the fact that there's a lot of very depressed people who write.
Well, humorists are notoriously of a very dark spirit. Nobody on earth has ever been darker spirited than Ring Lardner, say, unless it be Mark Twain. Lardner was always gloomy under any circumstances, but Twain on the stage as a performer showing off was radiant. But in real life, in his view of how life was, he took the darkest possible view. And that seemingly is the source of humor. It's a kind of preemptive strike against death and doom.
You know, a lot of people when they buy The New Yorker, everyone knows this is true, they look through the For the cartoons?
Mm-hmm. That's what everybody does, including everybody who works for The New Yorker.
Well, are you frustrated if you see somebody buying The New Yorker and flipping through it, skimming over all the writing and just going for the cartoons, going for the pictures?
I'm sort of resigned to it. Sometimes in the old days when I would have, I knew where a short story of mine was, say, in the magazine, and I would see people flipping through to see who had written it and then continue flipping. And that did cause a certain rueful feeling in me. But the fact is that all of us look at the cartoons first and rejoice to think that after all these years, there are still jokes about desert islands, which we haven't had for decades, which are funny.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was Frank Modell, or maybe it, no, it wasn't Frank, this week's issue of the magazine had a very funny joke about Noah's Ark. How can there still be jokes about Noah's Ark? But indeed there are, and they are funny.
You're really an anomaly in a way, being at one publication for over 50 years. Magazines are almost becoming like radio stations in how quickly yeah. management change and formats change. Did you ever feel funny about it? Did you ever feel like, oh, everybody else in the world is changing jobs and going on to different things, and here I am writing about whatever you wanted to, and for as long as you wanted to, and writing books on the side too, but still affiliated with the same magazine. Did you ever feel like, oh, everybody else is making a change, I'd better make one too?
Well, the only temptation would ever have been money, of course, which is the major temptation that most people face, and not sex, as a common misapprehension. And I was invited on other occasions to say to go to work for Time and places like that, which were notorious for paying two or three times as much as we at The New Yorker ever paid. But it was that freedom. And then, although it sounds as if I'd led a very steady, sedentary almost life by being on one publication, the fact was, as you imply, that I've been able to change jobs inside that, so that I was a movie reviewer, I was a drama reviewer, I'm an architectural reviewer, I've done almost everything there, so I changed jobs. And I was suspected in old age that they would then ask me to become a messenger and deliver manuscripts and things, and I would accept that, I hope, with the same joy that I accepted all my other assignments. And I wouldn't be less a part of The New Yorker if I did so.
You seem to be one of the few writers who you know who at least says that they actually enjoy writing.
Yeah, it's almost a shameful confession. It's a kind of a defect in a writer's character to admit it. But then I'm also the kind of person who, when he has written a book, loves to go around the country and talk about his book. And a lot of authors, to my indignation, pretend that this is a torture to them to have to expose themselves to the public in the course of peddling their wares. If they don't like going around this country and having the opportunity to go around this country, why on earth are they doing it? So it's a matter, it's a vogue, it's cant, it's nonsense. Writing is the easiest thing in the world given comparison with the ditch digger or a collector of garbage or any of the other horrible and backbreaking tasks that people perform. If people suffer writing, it is suffering plainly that they cling to and perhaps rejoice in. So then it doesn't become or can't be called suffering anymore.
Well, I enjoy your writing very much, and I want to thank you very much for joining us and talking to us about your work. Thank you for being here.
Delighted.
My guest has been Brendan Gill, and he's been affiliated with The New Yorker magazine for over 50 years. His best-selling book here at The New Yorker has just been brought out in a new updated edition. He also has a new biography of Frank Lloyd Wright, which is titled Many Masks, and that's just been published by Putnam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Terry Jones. For years, he was a member of the British comedy troupe Monty Python. He now writes children's books and directs films. His latest film was Personal Services, which was out over the summer. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with John Borman. The director of Deliverance and The Emerald Forest has a new film called Hope and Glory. It's based on Borman's childhood memories of England during the Second World War. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Robbie Robertson, the first solo album from the former leader of the rock group The Band. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Cry Freedom, the movie about black South African leader Stephen Biko and white South African journalist Donald Woods. It's directed by Sir Richard Attenborough. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. For White House and congressional budget negotiators, the day ended on a more pessimistic note than it began. This morning, both sides predicted an agreement on a deficit reduction package by the end of the week, perhaps as early as today. But when talks ended this afternoon, the mood had changed. House Majority Leader Thomas Foley said the deal bargainers had been working out appears to be unpopular with other lawmakers.
I'm still optimistic we're going to conclude the talks favorably, but there is, in my judgment, no likelihood of a resolution today, and we may not be able to resolve them this week.
Congress and the administration face a November 20th deadline for approval of a new deficit reduction package. Otherwise, automatic across-the-board cuts go into effect. Trade figures released by the Commerce Department today show an improvement in the nation's trade deficit. The U.S. trade imbalance in September was $14.1 billion, down $1.6 billion from August. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
It was the biggest one-month improvement in the trade imbalance in over 2.5 years. Imports were down for the month by about $800 million, thanks to fewer imports of manufactured goods such as cars and petroleum. Exports from the U.S., meanwhile, rose a similar amount due to increased sales overseas of U.S. manufactured goods, including cars, aircraft and parts, and office machinery. Experts had predicted a smaller drop in the trade deficit, so the figures released today should come as good news to Wall Street, which has been stressing the need for a reduction in the trade deficit and the federal budget deficit in order to restore confidence in the stock market. The White House said the lower trade deficit should be received well, and White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater used the occasion to urge Congress to pass what he called responsible trade legislation without protectionist provisions. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
Partially in response to those trade figures, stock prices were sharply higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 61 points to close at 1960.21. Advances led declines 13-1 on volume of 206 million shares. Nicaraguan Cardinal Miguel Obando y Bravo today left on a mediation mission. It's an attempt to bring about a ceasefire between the Sandinista government and the Contra rebels. The cardinal left for Washington today, where Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega held meetings with members of the Congress. Obando y Bravo also hopes to make contact with Contra leaders in the United States. A bus hit a landmine in northwestern Sri Lanka today, killing all 25 people aboard. From Colombo, John Reddy reports.
Few details are available of the landmine explosion, but if the death toll is correct, more Tamil civilians died than in any other incident since the main Indian offensive against the Tamil Tigers ended. There appear to have been no survivors among the passengers, and it isn't clear who was responsible. In Colombo, meanwhile, Parliament voted overwhelmingly for two controversial bills, one establishing provincial councils and the other amending the constitution to make this possible. The huge majority of the ruling UNP, the United National Party, steamrolled the opposition, which could muster only 11 votes against the constitutional amendment to 138 in favour. When it came to the Provincial Council's bill, the opposition simply melted away and allowed the UNP to pass it unanimously.
The BBC's John Reddy. The government of South Africa is now openly admitting that its forces are heavily involved in battles in Angola. The South African units are supporting the rebellious National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, or UNITA, led by Jonas Savimbi. South Africa said its troops have clashed directly with Cuban and Soviet forces. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Robbie Robertson has just recorded his first album since his group The Band broke up 10 years ago. It's called Robbie Robertson, and it features cameos by U2, Peter Gabriel, and former band members Rick Danko and Garth Hudson. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Distant red neon shivered in the heat. I was feeling like a stranger in a strange land. You know where people play games with the night. God, it was too hot to sleep.
Yes, believe it or not, that's Robbie Robertson emitting somber foolishness that sounds like third-rate Tom Waits. When a record goes as wrong as Robbie Robertson's new one has, you know you're in the presence of something special. From the mid-60s to the mid-70s, as the leader of the band, Robertson was one of the most influential musicians in rock and roll. There are songs on band albums such as Music from Big Pink, The Band, Stage Fright, and Cahoots, as well as the group's extraordinary collaborations with Bob Dylan, that can stand as high points in popular music. What I'm trying to say is Robbie Robertson is a gifted, important musician. The music on his new album, however, is, for the most part, depressingly mediocre. It's Robertson's first full-length rock record in a decade. He's done little more than score a few movie soundtracks over the past few years. Perhaps as a consequence, the music on Robbie Robertson has a thick, constipated sound, as if Robertson had been holding it in too long. That was Showdown at Big Sky by Robbie Robertson. Much of the music Robertson used to make with the band was dense and urgent. It had a lot to say about American history and its popular myths. By contrast, Robertson has absolutely nothing to say on this new record. Instead, he seems to be doing little more than paying homage to writers he may have read over the past 10 years. There's the overheated emotionalism of Erskine Caldwell and Jim Thompson on Hell's Half Acre. There's the hard-boiled prose of Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald in Somewhere Down the Crazy River. And American Roulette is full of the most fatuous sort of celebrity mongering. Robertson's thinly disguised portraits of James Dean and Marilyn Monroe sound like Norman Mailer on a bad day.
He was born in the belly of the country, over east of Eden, yeah. Confused by the big city blues, he didn't know whose life he's leading. No. Put yourself behind the wheel and see if you can get that feel. Oh, move faster by night, and move faster by night. The windows were all shattered and the body was all battered. American roulette, stake your life upon it. American roulette, same eyes, American roulette.
There is some good music on Robbie Robertson. Broken Arrow is a pretty ballad, even if Robertson's singing is distracting because it sounds so much like Tom Petty. A song called Sonny Got Caught in the Moonlight is full of sharp, specific details, not overblown abstractions, and Robertson and Rick Danko create some nice alley cat yowling together.
Robertson seems to bring out the best in U2, trading lines with Bono on Sweet Fire of Love that emphasize the solid rhythm rather than the vague portentousness of the lyrics.
Didn't we break the silence? Didn't we fear the storm? Didn't we move the earth? Didn't we shoot for the sky?
Robbie Robertson seems to have intended his album to be a big statement, but its ambitions are tangled in an off-putting self-importance. Veteran rock fans looking for more of the beauty and complexity of the music made by the band are bound to be disappointed. Younger fans are bound to wonder what this very sincere man is ranting about.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You're listening to Fresh Air. John Borman, who directed the films Deliverance, Excalibur, and The Emerald Forest, has made his first autobiographical movie. It's called Hope and Glory, and it's based on his childhood experiences during World War II. Borman was growing up in a lower middle class suburb of London when war broke out.
My memories of that time are very vivid, because I suppose it was such an extraordinary time, and I just happened to be coming into consciousness, as it were, you know, at the age of six when the war started. So those very crucial years I spent, you know, in amongst the Blitz and all the things that were going on. And the act of writing it triggered and released other memories.
Do you remember the first time that your block was bombed? What went through your head?
The raid I remember most vividly, the kind of raid, was the one which I show in the film, when we were sheltering under the stairs, and they used to drop these bombs in sequence with a 6-second intervals between the bombs, and you'd hear them getting closer. And each one got closer, you waited desperately for the next one, which would either hit you or go past you. And that was, I remember, the most terrifying thing. But for the most part, it was so random. There was this sense of, you know, rays, there was shelling, flak, akak, bombs would drop, and then it would there'd be an all clear, and then another raid would start. It was very fragmented, and of course, we all had the total conviction that we would be spared, and it would be other people who would be hit.
You know, you mentioned that during this raid that you described, you were terrified. But the feeling that really comes out during most of your movie, Hope and Glory, is the excitement of the war, because it broke up conventional middle-class life. And I guess it's hard for me, who's always lived in fear of war, to imagine what that would have been like to live through war, to have the bombs falling on your block, and not be terrified by it.
Well, certainly the terror was there. But as I say, most of the air raids took place at night, although happily there were some raids during the day, which allowed us, you know, if there was an air raid after 8 o'clock in the morning, we didn't have to go to school, which was wonderful. But most of them at night, and in the morning when people woke up, there was this sense of tremendous sense of elation at having survived. There was you know, you come out of the doctor and he's looked at the tests and he says, no, you haven't got cancer after all. And you look, you walk out of the street and suddenly everything is vivid and alive and wonderful. And that's somehow what it was like each morning. And there was this sense of exhilaration and there was determination to live life to the full, live it in the present. Whereas England at that time had been sleeping somehow, slumbering in a kind of somnolent state, living in a kind of dream of the past and vague hopes for the future. And suddenly they were thrust into the present moment.
This is probably the most personal film you've ever directed, yes?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you wrote it, you produced it, you directed it. It's about your life and your family. Did it pose any difficulties to you as a filmmaker to be that close to the material?
Quite the reverse, in a curious way. I thought that it would be, I would feel very vulnerable and exposed, and also that it would be difficult to make judgments because I was dealing with myself and my family. But it was quite curious because I found the necessary detachment quite easy to achieve once I was making the film. In fact, when I'd finished the film, I felt quite confident about it because I knew that it was right and I knew that it was true. And I'd made it from the heart. And instead of feeling desperately vulnerable about this, I felt very strong about it because I knew that if I was challenged or criticised for what something or other was in the film, it couldn't be because it was untrue either to the spirit or to the letter of those times and those people, because I knew that it was right.
How do you think exposure to war as a child affected your interest in or your use of violence as a filmmaker?
Well, it was a curious thing, you know, because whilst I was making the film, when I was shooting it and, well, writing it and editing it, I was always thinking myself back into the mind of the child and seeing it from his point of view, so that it wasn't until I'd finished the picture and looked at it with an audience that I looked at it in a kind of an objective way, and it struck me very forcibly that one or two things hit me unexpectedly. One was that this use of violence, because I'd always been asked about my use of violence in my films and I could never quite answer that. But I saw how I've often used violence as a kind of, as violence as liberation. And for instance, at the end of The Emerald Forest, the dam is blown up, which is a liberating act. In other films, I've done it in similar things. And I suppose that must have stemmed from that experience that of somehow perceiving it as a child as exhilarating and liberating. And perhaps I've kind of passed that on in my films.
Has Hope and Glory set you on a new course in your filmmaking?
Well, yes, I think in a sense, having had found the courage, you know, to speak from the heart and to have reached a point in my life of a certain mellowness where perhaps I see the world more as a comedy than a tragedy, I think I do feel somehow liberated from these darker forces that have driven me on in the past, and I see my future being trying to make people laugh rather than trying to terrify them.
When you remember your childhood now, do you think you're going to be remembering your childhood as you lived it or your movie?
That's a very interesting question. In one sense, in making the movie about my childhood, I've kind of lost my childhood because the movies intervene now between memory and artifice, and it's a curious thing. I suppose it happens to all of us in that we often, you know, remember telling the story about something remembered rather than the memory itself. So memory is, I mean, the relationship between memory and imagination fascinates me. How things, for instance, that I thought I was making up in when I was writing the script, the first draft of the script, turned out to be true. The relationship between film and memory, I think, is fascinating because I think that somehow memory is often takes the kind of form that movies take, you know, fragments, images. Film is perhaps closer to memory than other art forms. So it's a fascinating area altogether.
You said before that now you feel that you're more interested in comedy than in tragedy. Is your next film going to be a comedy?
I have an idea to make a picture which is a kind of has related in a sense to Hope and Glory because it's based on my relationship with my children growing up, a father and daughters. Perhaps you could describe it as a kind of comedy version of King Lear.
Ooh. Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
British filmmaker John Borman. His new film is called Hope and Glory. Borman spoke to us from the NPR studios in London.
There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover tomorrow. Just you wait and see.
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Welcome back, Robert. We haven't spoken for a while. You've been in the Soviet Union on assignment.
Just got back this week and back on the air yesterday, and it was terrific. You'll be hearing about it over the next couple of weeks.
On All Things Considered?
On All Things Considered.
What's coming up tonight?
Tonight we'll have a report on the trade deficit, a little bit brighter picture on that front this month than last. Also a report by Cokie Roberts on the status of the trade bill in the Congress. I'll be talking about Polish leader Wojciech Jaruzelski's proposal for reducing conventional weapons in Europe and a piece about the Navajos and AIDS. Are they especially at risk for AIDS?
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Richard Attenborough's 1982 film Gandhi won him both the American and British Academy Awards. His latest film, Cry Freedom, is about the life and death of the black South African leader Stephen Biko. It's also about Donald Woods, a white South African journalist who became Biko's friend and supporter. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
When bad movies happen to good causes, where does that leave the good causes? In the case of Richard Attenborough's Oscar-winning Gandhi, it didn't matter much. That movie genuflected in the general direction of sweetness and light without rubbing against anything very urgent. But Attenborough's new 2.5-hour epic is different. Cry Freedom is about the South African crisis, about the death of the black consciousness leader Stephen Biko, and the flight from South Africa of his friend, the white newspaper editor Donald Woods. The horrors these events emblemize are still very much with us, and we badly need a high-profile movie about South Africa. But after this, will audiences line up for the next one? I'm afraid Cry Freedom ruins a great movie subject for everyone. Not that it's a shoddy, unprofessional job. If Cry Freedom were really about Stephen Biko, Denzel Washington's performance alone might have saved it. He conveys something charged and mysterious behind the eyes. It's as though some inner factory were crackling away back there, converting reservoirs of violence and rage into the magnetic virtue of the Crusader. But Biko is less a character than a mouthpiece, and the rhetoric he spouts is the sort of stale, simplistic stuff you might remember from old Peter, Paul, and Mary records. It never even hints at the true complexities of the South African situation. The movie's real subject turns out to be Donald Woods, a brave man, to be sure, but really an observer in the struggle, not a major participant. It's as though Attenborough couldn't rely on us to swallow Biko straight. He needed a honky hero. As Woods, Kevin Kline gives a restrained, earnest performance. He seems terribly awed. His escape from South Africa is meant to be the movie's climax, but it's propelled by so much false suspense and trumped-up emotion that you can almost hear the wind being puffed into the movie's ragged sails. Take, for instance, this argument between Woods and his recalcitrant wife.
We may hate the bastards that run this country, but this is still our home.
What do you want to do? Just accept Steve's death? Except what this government's doing and is going to go on doing.
What more do you want to do? You forced the inquest. You're banned. Are you so God almighty grand you think you can change them all on your own?
I'm going to do what I can. I'm certainly not going to sit in that house bound and gagged for 5 years and do nothing.
And to hell with us. What do we do? Where do we go? Donald, we've got 5 children. We couldn't take a penny out of here. I know you. You're willing to tear our lives apart just to see Donald Woods on a book cover.
In real life, Wendy Woods was more fiercely radical than her husband. But of course, that's a pretty small distortion. And one might argue that when bad movies happen to good causes, not much harm is done. Even a clumsy outcry against injustice is better than none. But I'm not so sure. Any reader of a good daily newspaper already knows more about South Africa than this movie offers. And for those who know very little, gulping down Cry Freedom's blend of primer-grade history and white man's burden is like taking a little poison with your vitamin. The pill's awfully pretty. Every shanty is perfectly lighted. In fact, the movie has a kind of neo-colonial enthusiasm for the picturesqueness of squalor. Cry Freedom is a postcard of misery, a snapshot from a tourist bus. Come April, I'd hate to see Richard Attenborough up there again, thanking suffering South Africa for getting him his Oscar.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with songwriter and singer August Darnell. His stage persona is the dapper and womanizing Kid Creole. His band, Kid Creole and the Coconuts, does a stage show inspired by Hollywood production numbers. Also, American-born Irish fiddle champions Siobhan Egan and Eileen Ivers will perform a reel and a jig. And critic at large Laurie Stone will discuss the new ABC television series 30-something and its version of the baby boom generation. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Fred Landrell, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.